This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch. Have you ever found yourself using a term while having the awful nagging sense that you might not actually know what it means? Now, for me, such a term is financial well-being. At one point, I thought I knew what it meant. But just like egregious, plethora, and on fleek, its essence then escaped me. However, today's guest, Professor Del Atkinson, certainly does know her definitions. Previously heading up work across over 120 countries on financial well-being, education and inclusion at the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, Adele is now Professor of Practice in Financial Literacy and Wellbeing at the University of Birmingham's Centre for Household Assets and Savings Management, CASM. So resisting the urge to ask her about academics and abbreviations, I just love them, don't I? We instead definitely establish what financial well-being means, why its different elements can affect consumer thinking and behaviour on a daily basis, and how our new book, Beyond Money, is bringing a human perspective to finance and banking. Adele, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. It's fantastic to have you. It's fantastic to have you in the UK because you're travelling so much all over the globe. And you're going to tell us a bit more about this and tell us a bit about how did you find yourself working in this field around financial well-being, education, literacy, capability, and what's your current focus at the moment?
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me. It's really interesting to talk to you about something that I've been talking to many other people about around the world and to put this into the UK context. A lot of my research does take me around the world because for a long time I was working with a network of over 120 countries while I was at the OECD. They're all countries that have some kind of policy related to financial education, sometimes financial literacy, sometimes financial inclusion and financial literacy, sometimes financial well-being like we have in the UK. So, yeah, it's taken me all over the world, sometimes helping them to set up national strategies, sometimes talking to them about recent findings from research, but always focusing on what we can do to help people to manage their money, to live in a way that tries to maximise their financial well-being.
Now, today we're talking about financial well-being, and it's a term that seems to be used absolutely everywhere and with a million different meanings. But what does financial well-being mean?
Yeah, it's still not a very simple answer, unfortunately. And I think you're right, there are quite a lot of different ways that people are interpreting it. And in fact, it was odd because it's been used for a long time as a term, but it was relatively recently that people decided to try to define it. So it often is used at the end of a definition of financial literacy or financial education because it's the intended outcome. But people didn't really narrow down what was meant by that. So Money and Pensions Service now have a national strategy that focuses on financial well-being. They talk about having a good relationship with your money, about feeling secure and in control, about being able to deal with unexpected shocks, and about having a healthy financial future. They also use this phrase to kind of summarize the resilient, confident, and empowered, which sounds really nice. Also potentially links back to financial capability or financial literacy. Some research that I've just completed with the University of Tartu and ESTA Foundation in Europe found that actually the way people think about their own financial well-being is a little bit different from that. So security is a really important aspect, and I think that comes out in every definition. But people also want an element of freedom and an element of pleasure. And they see those as fundamental aspects of their financial well-being. So it isn't a case of only having security and then thinking, perhaps now I can afford some pleasure. They want the three things in their lives.
That's really clear, because in the past I've struggled with it being a bit of a blancmange phrase that people use. And you think, okay, well, what does that mean? But you're focusing down there on that outcome state, however we define it. And those other terms like financial inclusion or capability or literacy, they sort of like overlap with it a little bit in terms of the run up to the outcome?
Yeah, they do. And financial inclusion is defined in a thousand different ways, and also very much depends on whether you're talking about highly developed economies like ours or whether you're talking about less developed countries that are rapidly evolving their financial landscape. So yeah, one of the things that you will see is that at the level of the United Nations, there's a move towards talking about the outcome of financial inclusion being financial health. So Queen Maxima of the Netherlands is the United Nations Secretary General Special Advocate, I believe, for financial health, and very much works to make sure that financial inclusion doesn't just mean access without properly taking into account what that access does for people. So again, outcome becomes incredibly important. And similarly, the OECD's work on financial literacy and financial education isn't only focusing on the input, but it's focusing on the outcome as being financial well-being. The other thing to mention in all of that soup of definitions is that financial consumer protection, so if you like the regulatory side of things, also now has a framework that's been created and endorsed by the G20 and the OECD that mentions the importance of financial well-being. So it's consistently seen as one of the outcomes of other approaches to help financial consumers, if you like.
So what you've touched on this a little bit, but I wonder, could we just define the key building blocks of financial well-being in a bit more detail? I just wonder what matters most and when, if it's possible to kind of answer that question.
It's kind of possible and impossible. It's a uniquely personal thing. When we think about our well-being, it perhaps feels clearer that it's uniquely personal. But financial well-being is the same. Different people want it to look differently and they focus on different aspects. But it won't come as any surprise. And of course, it's a little bit disappointing that income has such a huge role to play. If we don't have sufficient income, then we can't really manage day to day in the societies that we live in. So it has a significant impact on the amount of security that you can build for yourself, but also on your ability to change direction, to afford small pleasures and so on. And that comes out in both qualitative research and quantitative research. So it doesn't mean that income is a proxy for financial well-being. It doesn't mean that you can just say, oh, look, that person's rich, therefore that person has financial well-being. But the other side of that is that what you can say is that if somebody doesn't have enough money to put the basics in place, to get a secure place to live, for example, to put food on the table, to have heat when they need heat or cooling if they need cooling, then it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about financial well-being. Those people are really in a survival mode and they're not really yet at the point where it seems appropriate to put them on a scale of financial well-being, because that really is the nice to have, the peace of mind. And by definition, people on very low incomes don't have the peace of mind, sadly. So that's really the strong bit, but it's certainly not the only thing that's going into financial well-being. Definitely there's an element of social connection, of comparison with others, but also of being able to interact with other people, to be able to share things, to be able to do activities together, for example. There's a lot of emotional terms that come in when you do qualitative studies with people, when you actually talk to them. They talk about their feelings of comfort, their feelings of stress, their satisfaction. Some of them even talk about how money is impacting on their relationship, and they see that as a good way of gauging what their financial well-being looks like. So if they find they're arguing with their partner, then their financial well-being doesn't look so great. If they find that it's an enabling factor, then that's obviously really positive. Quantitative data also shows, sadly, that at any level of income or liabilities, women tend to judge their financial well-being to be lower than men. So there seems to be some kind of gender gap. In a sense, that makes sense, because even if you have the same amount of assets, if your life expectancy is longer, then it has to be spread over more years. So there is some logic to it, but it's still slightly disappointing.
Talking about vulnerability, I'm really interested in your thoughts on the relationship between these two, almost like kind of a seismic plate between financial well-being and the term vulnerability. Two totems, two concepts out there. Is it possible to link the two in a way that makes sense, or should we just keep them at arm's length and let them get on with their work?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. So one of the other things in my list that I haven't yet mentioned is that health has quite a big impact and association with financial well-being. So to the extent that people with poor health are also vulnerable, we can see that there's going to be a two-way relationship between their financial well-being and potentially with their health, both their physical health and their mental health, potentially. So in the qualitative research that we did, for example, people talked about how they couldn't feed themselves. So again, they can feed themselves to some extent, but not to the extent that they would like. But again, this is the kind of pre-financial well-being, if you like. So they're again in survival mode. But there are nuances. So we definitely know that vulnerable people are likely to be experiencing lower levels of financial well-being, or indeed no financial well-being. Whether or not it's the first thing that you would want to solve is another matter. But one interesting conversation I had workshopping financial well-being after we'd completed the research with the University of Tartu was about this idea of, could I afford to replace my fridge if it broke down? It's a fairly standard question when you try to think about financial well-being. And it's a question that we'd been asking in the University of Tartu work as well. And this person explained that I cannot afford to buy a new fridge, but I have a strategy and I know exactly what I would do if my fridge broke down. I have a small cellar. I can put food in there for the short term. And I know that if I keep an eye on somewhere like Facebook Marketplace, I will be able to find a fridge. And I have the network to help me to pick it up and bring it to my house. So even though, in theory, I cannot tick that box to say, yes, I could afford to buy a new fridge, I would never need to buy a new fridge. And so I tick the box. And I really like that. And that level of resilience means that in their mind, their financial well-being is fine, because they are in a position where the problems that may arise can be solved without necessarily impacting on their financial circumstance. It doesn't work for everybody, and it doesn't mean that we should say, you know, you should solve all your problems by seeing what's free online. But it shows that people are able to think through their problems in a way that don't necessarily rely on a simple tap with a card, for example.
Mm. We talked about kind of the concepts of financial well-being and vulnerability. Let's go for the Holy Ghost, the Trinity then. I mean, where does financial inclusion fit into that kind of triumvirate?
Well, it does really depend on how you define financial inclusion in that case. CASM talks about financial inclusion as requiring three things. One is a secure income, which I've mentioned a little bit already and is a whole topic of research in itself. The other is access to appropriate financial products, which I think is probably what most people think about when they talk about financial inclusion. And the other one is access to appropriate advice and education. And we see quite often that the public and most providers believe that there's some element of knowledge that you need in order to be able to properly use the financial products and services that are available. But the products have to be there, and they have to be well designed, and they have to be sufficiently flexible and sufficiently tailored to meet the needs of different people at different stages in their life with different priorities in terms of their own financial futures. And at the moment, we still do see some gaps in all of that.
So we're talking about financial well-being, but our audience, people listening to this podcast, all 12 of them, work in essential services. Is it even possible to talk about how well essential services like energy, water, financial services, telecoms are doing, or what they're talking about, or how they're addressing financial well-being? Is this even a thing that they're considering right now, given everything else that's going on?
In a way, everything that we do has some influence on financial well-being. So inevitably, their behaviours are having an effect on how people perceive their own financial well-being. So if they're not thinking about it, then it's probably time to do so. It can be as simple as thinking about communications. And I know a lot of work's been done to simplify language that's used to make it more friendly. But one of the things, again, that comes out of really talking to people is that often it's not that they don't understand a term, but it's just not the way they use it. So a really good example is investment. When we talk to people about their financial well-being and they use the term investment, they clarify that they invest in their health, or they invest in their children, they invest in their future lives, but they don't necessarily use the word investment purely in a financial sense. They understand perfectly well what it means, but it's not how they see it. And we have to be quite careful about word associations. So if you're using a term that you know the public can understand, also we're thinking about what else it might be triggering, what else it might be making them think about. And I think from a perhaps more practical perspective, another area where it's really worth considering the needs of individuals is we live in a society where people don't necessarily have the same amount of income every month. And because of that, they welcome more flexibility. And often we've seen in both financial inclusion work and financial well-being work, problems can occur, not necessarily because there isn't enough money over the space of 12 months, but because there isn't enough money at the date at which a bill comes in. And I think we're going to have to build a society where expenditure better maps to income, because we're a little bit simplistic in the sense that even if somebody is entirely reliant on benefits, they're not necessarily getting the same amount every month. And various different things can come in the way of them being able to meet expenditures on certain days. So those are good practices to think about, even if they're not being thought about at the moment.
So when we think about improving financial well-being, the conversation often turns to data. And I wonder, any sense of how some of these essential service firms might use their own data better to understand and improve the financial well-being of their customers?
Yeah, so they do have a lot of data. We've got more data in this world now than we're ever going to be able to analyse. It's a challenge, but I think probably they already have a good sense of the quantitative data, but they never have the full information. So they know how big the bill is, but not how big the income is. Or they know how frequently people are, for example, turning on the heating, but they don't necessarily know whether that's because of a vulnerability or because of some other factor or because they've just not got sufficient insulation. So with gaps in data, it makes it really difficult. But one of the interesting things that they have, probably more than they ever had, is words. And I think that could be a really interesting way to look at their data overall in the future, to look at their social media interactions and so on, and actually try to understand how people talk about the services, the extent to which they talk about the impact on their financial well-being or their financial circumstances, the level of emotion that's involved in the language that's been used. And I think we probably overlook a lot of the information that is available that could be used.
Absolutely. Now, we normally say what one resource, book, online video or project on financial well-being or whatever the topic is would you urge us to go and look at? I'm going to give you two because you have a book, don't you?
I do have a book. So first and foremost, what I would say is go to the CASM website, which is the Centre on Household Assets and Savings Management at the University of Birmingham, because that's where I work and I make sure that everything is uploaded on the wonderful WYSI places. I don't even know what they're all called that we have at the university. So you should be able to find everything there. But seems I get two. That's great. So also, if you'd like to Google Beyond Money, maybe add Tartu University for good measure. And you should get a book that summarizes the 3-year study of qualitative and quantitative analysis of financial well-being in Europe. which is fascinating. It's written for a non-technical audience. It does have a few technical graphs in which you could probably flick through, but it's got so much information for everything from a little bit of a summary of how people stress bust by themselves right through to potential solutions for different sectors. So all very exciting stuff.
It's a terrific read. I've read some, don't test me, but I have read some of it. It's really well worth reading, and also Chasm as well. So if you could leave our listeners with one key message about financial well-being, something they can reflect on personally or apply in their own role, what would you leave them with?
Oh, I don't think I can leave them with just one thing, because I think we live in really challenging times. But if I could just say, from the financial well-being world that I seem to have been immersed in for these last few years, peace of mind comes out as top. So recognize when you have peace of mind. Try to remember what caused it and see if you can capture it and return to it as often as possible. That seems to be the key for real well-being overall across the populations that we spoke to.
Adele Atkinson, thank you very much. And that was Professor Adele Atkinson, demystifying what financial well-being actually means. You can find links to Adele's excellent work in the podcast notes, or you can search for Beyond Money, Tartu University, for a new co-authored book. Tartu is spelt D-A-R-T-U. And that's it for another episode. So next time, keep well, certainly keep on fleek, when are you never, and keep on remembering that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Mandy McGreevy and Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.